today there are a lot of people in their 60s or younger who are alive for the very one single reason that antibiotics existed, meaning that either our parents or ourselves or our children didn't die from what at one time were common childhood infections, infections of young adulthood, where people just literally would succumb to a infection that started out as a boil and got into the bloodstream and ended up dying. We have taken that kind of picture for granted in the sense that with antibiotics really becoming widely available in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s, and then many different classes of antibiotics, meaning different kinds that would treat different infections in the 60s and 70s, that we just forgot about that. We don't think anymore of the fact that two or three or four children die early in life. It was just interesting. I was watching a movie recently with some friends, Angela's Ashes, and a follow-up of the famous book by Frank McCourt. And they were so surprised to know that several of Frank McCourt's siblings all died at a very young age, all of them from infections that today we would never consider to be an acceptable outcome because we have antibiotics to treat those common infections, and back then they just died. Well, what the antibiotic resistance problem of today really presents us with is a return back to those days when we didn't have any antibiotics, because now if you can't treat the infections because the old antibiotics are not working anymore, that is something that as a society we're not really prepared for. We are so used to having conquered the bugs that it's hard for us to imagine going back to those times.
Okay, so what are some steps that society in general could be taking to prevent this?
Well, first of all, any use of antibiotics will by itself create some resistance. That's inevitable. So even if we use antibiotics appropriately, even if we use them the way that we're supposed to use them, that will have a very positive impact for an individual and as a society on a whole, we're still going to see some resistance. What happens with resistance is that once the antibiotic is in the presence of the bacteria, the virus, or even a parasite, there are certain organisms that will either mutate around the mechanism by which the antibiotic kills the cell, or they will acquire another piece of genetic material that will allow them to then bypass that type of killing step from the antibiotic. Once that happens, then the susceptible bugs, which are supposed to get killed, do get killed, and this one survives. Now, in some cases, the ones that actually survive are not disease-causing bugs themselves. They're just all the other normal flora or bacteria that's in the human body. Very few people, for example, realize that there are well over 450 different species of bacteria just in your mouth alone that we know of today, of which none of them cause disease, but they can pick up the genetic material that allows for resistance to be transferred. Bacteria, for example, are very promiscuous creatures. They have lots of sex between each other. And in doing that, it's often the organism that's not a disease-causing bug that can actually transfer resistance to an antibiotic by inserting a piece of genetic material into a disease-causing bug, so you can get transfer even, and that occurs. When that happens, now you have the situation where you can't treat the infection effectively, or if you can treat it effectively, you may not have to use new and much more powerful drugs, which then themselves spur on resistance. The way that we see most resistance, however, occurring today is really a function of overuse of antibiotics. It's basically throwing this broad net of antibiotic use out there that we don't need. Common colds do not need to be treated with antibiotics. Most ear infections in children do not need to be treated with antibiotics. And it's this overuse that is really the problem. That's what's fueling the fire. So from a public health and a clinical perspective, the real message today has to be what we call good stewardship of antibiotics. We can't waste them. We've got to use them effectively when we need them, and not use them when we don't. And that's what I think the real public health message is today, and that's how we're trying to help physicians do a better job of understanding when they should prescribe an antibiotic, when they shouldn't, and what antibiotic they should use. I currently chair the Emergent Infections Committee for the Infectious Disease Society of America. IDSA is the leading clinical infectious disease group in the world, and the whole area of antibiotic resistance fits under my committee. And I have to tell you that as a order of importance, there is very few things in the whole area of infectious disease that are more important than the issue of emergence of antibiotic resistance and how we treat those infections. And our committee takes that situation very seriously. Yet, even as an internationally recognized group and a committee of esteemed scientists, we're struggling on how to help physicians practice medicine better because there just aren't the tools there yet that really are these information systems that can quickly factor in what's the likelihood that it's an infectious agent causing the condition. If it is an infectious agent, what's the likelihood it's a given infectious agent? If it is a given infectious agent, what's the likelihood that it's resistant to any number of different antibiotics? And then what antibiotics should you use if, in fact, that's the case? Now, think of trying to put all that in together into one quick decision that today in managed care, where you're required to see 45, 50, or 60 patients a day, you now suddenly just have to make that decision like that. And short of coming up with better systems for helping the area of prescribing, I'm not sure that we're going to improve much. And if we don't improve on the use of antibiotics in humans and in animals and in the environment in general, we're only going to continue to see this rapid acceleration of antibiotic resistance, which means we better start getting ready to go back to the 1910s, 20s, and 30s when infectious diseases killed a lot more of us than they do today.
Let's shift gears and talk about the whole issue of it being an agricultural feed. In terms of proof that it works, that it's becoming a problem there, where do you see that?
I think the issue of proof is one of those things that it's in the eyes of the beholder. If I see someone hold up a gun, I see a flash of light, I realize that the bullet that's recovered from that individual came from that barrel, but I didn't see the bullet actually fly because it was faster than my eyes could ever allow me to. Can I conclude that, in fact, somebody just shot someone? In fact, there we really believe that there's more than adequate evidence from a number of different studies to show that antibiotic resistance does occur as a result of the use of these antibiotics in these animal populations. Best example I can give you are data right here from Minnesota that we began working on in the Minnesota Department of Health in the mid-1990s, showing that the frequency with which Campylobacter acquired resistance to a certain kind of antibiotic began to increase dramatically in people who never left the state of Minnesota in the mid-1990s. Campylobacter is the most common cause of bacterial diarrhea in the state and is a frequent contaminant of chicken. When we did further work, we actually found that about a quarter of all the chickens sold in the state of Minnesota not only had Campylobacter on it, but had this type of resistant Campylobacter on it that corresponded exactly to the kinds of resistance we would see if you use this drug in the chicken environments. What happened was in the mid-1990s, the FDA approved its use in order to allow these large flock of chickens to basically be under one roof and not die of respiratory infections. And so sure enough, to see the resistance wasn't surprising. As this use occurred in these chickens, we saw human cases just go straight up. And when we actually did the genetic fingerprinting between the these resistant bugs on the chicken and the resistant bugs in the humans, they were identical. They were fingerprinted exactly the same. Whereas if I went to Mexico or I went to South America or I went somewhere else and acquired Campylobacter, genetically they were very different. So it was almost a lock and a key. That all coincided exactly with the first use of this antibiotic in these chickens. So I think we have a number of examples like that, where it's not just the fact that we saw resistance in humans, we saw it in the animals, but temporally we can actually show when the introduction occurs in the animals, the resistant bugs show up on the food product area, and then the humans get it. I think that the national issue is being addressed. None of us would ever agree that it's fast enough, but on the other hand, there's others who think it's going too fast if you're potentially on the industry side, so I think that must tell us that it's probably about the right speed of what can be done. And so I think this is an urgent issue, but I think it's one that is just part of the big problem of antibiotic resistance. Remember, it's not just animals and animal feeds and resistance, it's humans too. It's those of us that go to the doctor, you know, year in and year out and get our antibiotics for something we don't need them for. So it really isn't a single problem caused by a single bullet. It really is caused by a whole lot of different things all occurring at the same time. We really need to address all of them simultaneously.